Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. I'm Dr. Stephen Nurse, and I'm the moderator of the show. Today we're going to interview Kirsten Becker, and she is the most patient woman I have ever met. We have been dealing with our technical difficulties here after a power outage on Vashon. The whole island went out of power last night, and fortunately I have a wood stove, so that was good. And I do want to also preface this with, Kirsten is going to talk about anchoring dogs, but she and I actually met in a real life situation in a school district where a parent was considering an anchoring dog for their young child, who I think was on the autism spectrum. But that's when I learned about it, and that's when I knew what a great spokesman Kirsten was for anchoring dogs. So, Kirsten, why don't you just let's just have a real informal discussion here, because I think it's such an interesting subject. Your title is go ahead.
Yeah, I'm the founder and executive director, actually even the president of Autism Anchoring Dogs.
That's good. You know, it's like sometimes the more titles we have, it just means we do more work. We don't get paid anymore, you know. But
exactly.
Yes, yes. And what are your responsibilities? It sounds like that you do a little bit of everything.
We're a very small company, so my responsibilities include any administrative tasks that come up, you know, including processing applications, finding funding, doing the administrative duties, working with the volunteer puppy raisers, coordinating the team trainings that we do in our clients' hometowns, resolving any problems, heavy client contact, and my favorite thing is matching up the candidate service dogs with a client family. And, you know, that's always the best thing, because if you get it right, it's a really beautiful thing to watch. And even when we don't quite get it right, it usually works out in the end. So
yes.
I'm pretty happy about that.
I think dogs are pretty smart. As I was mentioning, I just got a new service dog, Maya, and she has already glued herself to me. And when we go out and work, she's tired at the end of the day. Another question that I have is just simply, how did you get, it seems like an interesting area to get into, but what led you to get into this area of anchoring dogs?
Well, I'll give you a little backstory. In 2006, I was on vacation, and my former spouse had taken my son to Crater Lake Wilderness area, National Park down here in Oregon, and they'd gotten into an argument, and my 8-year-old son ran away and has never been found. I've been on 10 search and rescues for his remains, and we've never been able to bring anything back. So that elopement incident pretty much cut me off at the knees. And about 4 years later, I was talking to somebody about collies, because I'd rescued a collie named Drover. And she said, well, you know, you're interested in these giant breed dogs. Why don't, there's a Sentinels for Safety up in Canada was a paper that was written by Karen Barros. And it talked about 7 cases where they had used some of these big English labs that weigh about 90 pounds to stop children from wandering and eloping. And that just flipped a switch in my mind, and I had a future and I had a purpose again. So I've been pursuing that since that time.
Wow, that's quite a background there. Had you heard about the the dogs working with persons that were eloping. And I guess we need to kind of explain that term. Go ahead.
So elopement, wandering and elopement is actually a medical term. It's indicative of inadvertent self-harm. And what it means is bolting away from safety or just sort of wandering off. And because it's so subtle, people don't notice. In Sam's case, it was running away very quickly and hiding. And this was only the third major elopement that he'd ever done in his life. And the other two were Amber Alerts here in Portland, Oregon. Wandering and elopement has about one in eight of children, usually on the autism spectrum, who run end up grounding subsequent to elopement. So if we can save those children one dog at a time, then I'm all up for it, because I don't want any other family to go through the grief and suffering that I've gone through.
You know, we have a family here that on the island who I've worked with, and she has a son who is on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. And she really doesn't have a dog that's you know, considered an anchoring dog, but in many cases serves the same purpose when he was to go independently from the house to the bus stop. And the dog knew that trip and, you know, knew how to do that. And it really gave the family a lot more security and a lot more independence, you know, in that.
Yes. A lot of these families are pretty shut down and isolated because, well, first of all, their child is autistic, and that means that sometimes they are getting very overwhelmed in various sensory situations. So it may be the wind blowing across their face. It may be the blue fluorescent lights in the school. It may be wanting to watch wheels on vehicles or how a train moves. Many of these things are fascinating. And they will run towards things with no regard to their own safety. Service dogs have the smaller breeds, and to me, you have to understand, autism anchoring dogs work strictly with giant breed dogs. So we're placing mostly Newfoundlands with kids that weigh between 30 pounds and younger individuals up to 175 pounds. That's what I can guarantee the dogs will recognize.
So you have no anchoring Chihuahuas?
No.
Okay.
No. And I won't train anything less than 100 pounds.
Right.
It's not sensible. And we're doing all the upfront work of looking at pedigrees and health clearances and things like that. So we're pretty strong with the breeders that we work with. And what these dogs do is I think children with autism have a real affinity for animals. They may lash out inadvertently during a sensory overload and hurt maybe the people closest to them or teachers or their therapists, whatever. But they don't with animals. And, you know, all I can think of is animals to them are predictive. They react to what is given to them. So if a child approaches them in the need of comfort, they'll sense that, and they will, you know, curl up around a child that's sobbing miserably on the floor because they were made to go into Bed Bath and Beyond. You know, they will put their head in a lap of a child that's getting more and more agitated because they have to walk through a mall. You know, so these things we know happen. We don't know exactly how the dogs calm the child, but we do find it rather sort of miraculous or magic. We always tell the parents we don't know what the baseline is.
And I
but
think
the dog's going to do something. So,
I was thinking, too, you know, that animals, the dogs, you know, essentially when you pet a dog you know, if the dog is trained, they don't respond in anger like an adult would, or some other person would yell back at the kid or say, don't do that. But a dog doesn't have that same way of doing things. Now, you also mentioned kind of triggers with kids that are autistic, and you know, what sets them off. And I don't want to take too much time here, but when I was working at the university and doing research, we had a young man with autism who was scratching himself and really hurting himself.
Yeah.
And so we got all these smarty pants professors together and doctors and everybody else. And we said, you know, what is causing this? What is the problem? What is the trigger? And then someone finally said, I wonder if he's allergic to the laundry detergent. And my gosh, you know, somebody checked with mom, and mom said she'd used a different laundry detergent. And that was the trigger. And I think so many times, you know, we try to overanalyze these things when it really is something very simple, like you mentioned with the wheels or certain colors, or just anything can be a trigger.
Yes. And you don't know what it is because different senses are affected. Some child might be visual, so they're stemming or self-stimulating, might be flapping their hands in front of their face or opening and closing their fingers in different ways to accept the data that's coming in, because all these kids are very smart. Whether or not they can communicate that or articulate that is completely different, but I haven't met, I've only met really smart kids.
Right.
And even the nonverbal ones, you can see they're absorbing stuff out of their environment. Whether or not they'll ever connect on a verbal level, it doesn't matter. They're still very smart.
And there's also some research that says sometimes when the students do the echolalic behavior, the, you know, running, you know, moving the fingers in front of the face, that part of the research says that where you and I can cut out maybe the noise of the fan or cut out something around us, these children just take everything in as stimulation. And one of the reasons that they may do that is so that they can only focus on one thing. You focus on those fingers, and you're not focusing on everything else.
I've talked with enough autistic adults to know that it is a self-calming method. Any stemming, whether or not you've been in a meeting where someone is irritatingly clicking a pen, right? That's self-stimulating. We do it as, you know, normative people.
Right.
But the kids with autism have a lot of different things. They may hoot. They may hand slap. They may, they may suck on their lower lip. They rarely make eye contact because it's overwhelming for them to do that. They have to basically learn how to do it safely. And actually, the dogs can help with that because they will look deeply into a child's eyes with no agenda, and the child is able to look back at them and know that they're loved.
We've always, I kind of butted in there, but in a previous interview we were doing, and I've done so many times, is people that use service dogs, this other gentleman who's quadriplegic, and the question that I asked him was, do you think your dog can tell your temperament? And I think that's 100%, don't you?
Oh, yeah. They're used to reading micro expressions. You might hear the FBI trains its people, interviewers, interrogators, to do that. But dogs have them beat because not only do they have the senses to watch what goes on with the handler's face, but they're watching the body cues, and they're also catching into the heartbeat and to any scent cues that come from chemical changes, like a dump of adrenal cortisol into the system right before a child decides to run. So these dogs are, in terms of an organic sensory machine, dogs are an incredible advantage in a world for anyone with a disability.
Yeah.
And I think you know, the handlers and the people affected really hone into that because they need that. They need that unquestioning support and loyalty and love, and that gives them the confidence and the ability to tolerate more in the day-to-day world.
Well, I definitely heard that they said that when it comes to the sense of smell, that dogs have a leg up on all of us. So
millions.
Times. Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
So, anything else? How about one of the things I guess I should always mention is, are these dogs for sale? I mean, obviously you place them with the right person, but is there a cost? I'm sure there is a cost.
We are a nonprofit, and the cost of the dogs should be, if I was doing it ideally, and actually, paying myself some sort of salary, they would probably be about $35,000. But I have dedicated my savings and my life to trying to keep the cost down. So right now, we're currently they're for purchase at $25,000 plus the cost of us coming to a client's hometown and training there for 2 weeks, which is about 80 hours of one-on-one training with, two of our staff members and two handlers. So it's a lot of people. I was told 3 years ago that I should be putting them at about $33,000, and now a lot of companies, the cost of the dogs is about $40,000.
And I think that would be the reason that people really need to evaluate that this is not just an expensive pet, that this is
this is a
working animal, this is something that's and I'm sure that you're very specific on how you choose who these dogs go to,
This is my feeling in the matter. If somebody comes to me and says, my child's eloping, I'm scared for their life, I think that this is the way to go, I can't really afford this, what do I do? And I tell them the truth. Practically all of our families have to grassroots fundraise, and I'm not going to turn somebody away. The only reason that we would turn somebody away is if they were incapable of handling a giant breed dog.
Right.
Although we have trained for people using canes and other disabilities.
Sure.
We just have to know in advance if we're going to train to a right side or a left side, or if they're, able-bodied, capable of handling such a large animal, because all our dogs are over 100 pounds, and some go up to about 150 pounds. So these are not small animals.
And I know that...
they're very calm, but...
And I know that one of the things, too, sorry to talk over you there.
But
one of the things I was going to say is, I know with the person that got the dog here in town that there was a fundraiser for that. And I think that that's very appropriate. And I'm sure that that happens all the time. And
well, just so you understand, I think it was the Kennedy Center in New York did a study on about 3,700 families with autistic children. And one of the statistics they posted was, and this was in 2014, I believe the paper came out, and they said that their findings were families with one autistic child were spending between $17,000 and $60,000 more annually for the care of that child. So these are people that basically an income goes to support a child on the spectrum, and I can't expect them to pay the going, sure, the full going rate. And we do put them in contact with other clients that are their peers that have fundraised the whole cost of the dog.
And don't you think that's, I think that's true of all disabilities in a lot of respects. You met me and I drive from my electric wheelchair.
Right.
But even though I have a Chrysler minivan, I call it my, my handicapped Mercedes because by the time I got all the equipment on that, it was over $65,000.
Yeah.
And then you look at an electric wheelchair. I just got an electric wheelchair and the entire cost was, $40,000. So think about people with visual impairments, technology for computers, technology for all other kinds of things. I think that's true of a lot of disabilities.
And the other thing about cost is, I would suspect that some insurance companies might subsidize part of these medical devices. Well, the IRS defines a service dog as a piece of durable medical equipment, just as your electric wheelchair would be. But no insurance company will fund them because there is no standard for what the dogs need to meet in terms of their training and their public access work. And I'm a great advocate of that. We train to place dogs in Canada, and they have to go and pay $200 and have the department, the Ministry of Justice, provide a test administrator, and they have to pass a 6-page international test in order to be certified and registered within the government and provided handler tags and service dog tags. And that would be prohibitive for a lot of people with disabilities, but it would still also allow them a way to know that the standardization of any service dog out in public access situations would be properly trained, because I can't tell you how many times I've gone to the airport and pulled off a small, and unfortunately it's always been a small white fluffy dog off the neck of one of our dogs that we're taking to place on an airplane.
Yes. Just a couple other questions.
Yes.
You can give me your honest opinion, and I have my honest opinion on this.
Yeah.
How do you feel about people that or agencies that give out certificates for people to have certified dogs when they're not?
According to the American with Disabilities Act, it's not necessary. There's no such thing as a registry or certification. I do know that there are a couple of states that are looking to pass laws, if they haven't already, to have some sort of service dog registry. It used to be that you had to train the dog in public access work over 6 months, and it had to be a minimum of 120 hours of public access work. And I've been a mentor on some of these self-training forums for people, and I've just suggested to people that they need to aim higher, that showing that your dog is obedient is fine, but showing your dog is obedient in a busy mall with food being strewn about it and another untrained dog going across its vision. I mean, you need to have a dog that's focused on the handler at all times.
Yes.
That's what the purpose of a service dog is to take care, to mitigate a disability.
Yeah, I train my dog, or I work with my dog. She's, Maya is, we go through certification every year, or have people, I run her through our a series of tests, but one of the places we go is a Home Depot where there are all kinds of noises. And she needs to stay focused on me, you know, and not on the guy demonstrating the circular saw that makes lots of noise. Or Costco. Fortunately, now with the, well, with COVID now, they don't have as many sampling places at Costco as they used to. But even those kinds of things. But, well, I know we're just about coming to the end of our time, and I will make sure that I get to you the information on how to get to this, our conversation. And I have to say I'm amazed at your knowledge in this area, and I agree with you on the IRS. I can take as a medical expense, I can take off my cost of I can take off my cost for my dog for food and vet bills, and of course with a with a dog like a Newfie, that's probably $30,000 to $40,000 a year in food in kibble. So
I'll tell you the truth. I've done the numbers, and it's about $1,000 a dog average for food and treats.
Is that right?
For a year. Yeah.
Yes.
But it just adds up. There's always little.
It does, and I have to watch. Now I have one retired dog, and so now when I cook in the kitchen or when it comes 4 o'clock for dinner time, I have a half an hour before I have four eyes staring at me all the time.
Yes.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, and I hope we meet again up here in person.
I would be delighted if that could happen.
Yes.
And Steve, it's been just a pleasure talking with you. And thank you so much for bringing this to your listeners there on Vashon. And I'm glad that you're doing this service for your community to help them educate themselves about service dogs and the law. I appreciate that so much.
Well, thank you very much. And with that, we will close our program for today. And thank you very much, Kirsten. And we'll be in touch.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. That closes our episode for today. And we're looking forward to future episodes about dogs and whatever has to do with disabilities. So thank you very much, and we will see you again next Tuesday. Well, we won't see you. Unless you come by here, we might see you. But other than that, we will hear you again next Tuesday.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.